Blog Talk Radio.
White Supremacy, Gusty Renegade, and Justice in for another program to share constructive information on racism, white supremacy, what it is, and how it works. Thank you, everyone, for tuning into the broadcast. This program is being simulcast. It is broadcasting live at Blog Talk Radio as well as live on the War on the Horizon Radio Network. You can call into the program. The number you can use is 760-569-7676, and the participation code is 948656. I'll give it to you one more time. The number you can dial, 760-569-7676, and the participation code is 948656. I'll give that out one more time as we roll through the program in case folks are tuning in a little later and did not get the number. This program should be very important. People should have a whole new lens with which to view historically black colleges and universities, as well as Carter G. Woodson's book, the title of his book, Miseducation of the Negro. That should take on a whole new significance after hearing the information that we get from today's book. Our guest for today's program, he has a PhD from the University of Illinois at Chicago. He has been a faculty member at the University of Utah and is currently a professor in the College of Education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He has authored several books. He has authored several books, including Blood Test, Thought and Education, as well as Race and Education, The Roles of History and Society in Educating African American Students. The book we're going to talk about today, specifically, The White Architects of Black Education, Ideology, and Power in America from 1865 through 1954. Outstanding work, and I think the program will speak for itself, but in my opinion, outstanding work, and a real pleasure to have him on the program, our guest, Professor William Watkins. Professor Watkins, are you with us?
I am. Good evening.
Good evening, sir. Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your Tuesday evening with us. Real privilege to have you on the program, sir.
Thank you for having me.
For sure, for sure. I guess for folks who might be listening who may not have heard you before, may not have read some of your work, could you give us a little bit of background information just so folks will know a little bit more about who you are?
Well, I'm just a regular brother. I was born in Harlem, grew up in South Central LA. I was fortunate enough to get an education, and I've been a high school teacher and a university professor for the last 26 years. So I do research on issues of race and power. You've already acknowledged some of the work that I've done. I continue to teach and research and write and try to share my findings with as large an audience as I possibly can.
We are appreciative that our audience will be privileged to that information today. You pretty much already said that you are a black male. Is that correct?
That is correct. Last time I checked.
Got you. Good to know. This program, The Cows, Context of White Supremacy, I unfortunately concluded that we are in a global system of racism, white supremacy. I use those two terms interchangeably, and I use the same definition for both terms. That definition is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you believe that such a system exists, and do you think that definition is accurate?
Well, I certainly believe that colonialism has dominated the world since the emergence of Europe following the Renaissance. And colonialism has taken the form of white supremacy. It was Western European countries that set about to explore and then conquer and exploit the colored people of the world. So while I may not use the exact same terminology that you do, I think our understandings are very kindred and similar.
Okay. In your opinion, colonialism and white supremacy, are those one and the same?
Well, they've become drawn together because the colonialists were largely white and came to see themselves and saw themselves early on as superior to the people of color that they were conquering. So no doubt that the conquest of the last several centuries has certainly, white supremacy has been an important tenet of that ideology.
Okay.
I believe also that there are some commercial issues, some issues of imperialism that have to be explored alongside the fellow question. But we can talk about that as we go along.
Right, and that is the plan. Groovy, my co-host, she should be with us as well. Justice, if you are with us, your line should be open. If you have questions that you would like to ask Professor William Watkins, please go right ahead.
Hello, Mr. Watkins.
Hello.
How and why did you become a sociologist?
Well, I grew up in a working-class, blue-collar family. I was always interested in why we were poor, why black people were mistreated. At an early age, I became interested in the world around me. And although I wasn't the brightest student in school, I was certainly one of the most hardworking. And I was able to just continue and deepen my studies and my travel and my research. And so where I am. Hello?
Can you explain what the title of your book means, White Architects of Black Education, Ideology, and Power in America?
Yes. Those people designed the system of segregated education that so dominated our people and continue to dominate our people. And so I wanted to use the word architecture to demonstrate the constructed nature of that educational system. And that it, in fact, contained political bias, racial bias, ideological bias. We've all come to know it as segregated education. And it didn't just fall from the sky. I wanted to look at who put it together, what their ideas were, where the money was coming from, what their goals were for society, and how they fit into the issues of the day. And the issues of their day are very clearly the dominant issue of their day was the situating of black people. We had this horrific war that divided the country down the middle. And the question of how to rebuild the nation and what to do with black folks became central to the country moving forward. And the education, or I should say miseducation, of black folks became an important ingredient to the what I call the social engineering of America. Hence the title, The World Architecture of Black Education, and it is a study of ideology and power following the Civil War on up to the post-World War II period.
I am going to read a brief passage from page 179 in your book, and then ask a question about it. It would be a study of how the political, economic, and cultural power structures came together to influence knowledge selection, shape education policy, and consolidate a society stratified by race, class, and obviously gender. Above all, it was to be a study in ideology and how to dominate economic and socio-political interest shaped schooling for blacks, the curriculum, and ultimately the social life of the country. My question is, what is your definition of black?
My definition of black is the people of color, the African, enslaved Africans that were, in the sense that I'm using it, refers to the enslaved Africans who were brought here and placed into chattel slavery, exploited, oppressed, deprived of family life, cultural life, civil life, and became tools of oppression and wealth for a powerful group of folks.
Do you think your work helps to combat racism, white supremacy? If so, how?
I don't know. I didn't write the book with the intention of converting racist to a different position. I wrote the book to inform, to educate, and hopefully people who have information and education can make better decisions and have a better understanding of what's going on in the past and where they can go in the future. So I'm not sure, I'm not making any claims that I'm converting anyone in their race of ways. So that was not my mission, and again, nor do I claim it.
Okay, those will be all of my questions at this moment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Context of white supremacy. I kind of want to set the table for this episode. The white architects of black education, I want to kind of share my view in terms of what this work means, what you lay out in this work, and see if I got it correctly. Maybe I misinterpreted. Carter G. Woodson's Miseducation of the Negro, I think one of the seminal lines from that book, when you control a man's thinking, you do not have to worry about his actions. You already used the term social engineering. I used it in the book. You already have used it on the program. And when I think about social engineering, to me that means when you are able to construct an environment that will influence, guide an entire group of people's way of thinking, speaking, and acting, maybe even unbeknownst to them. We just had Dr. Charles M. Payne on the program. He's also done a lot of work around racism and education, and we just talked about his book Sunday, So Much Reform, So Little Change. So many things have been tinkered with, and yet we still have just an abysmal state of education for black youth, for a lot of students, period, but especially black youth. And when he was on the program, I asked him, you know, what is the purpose of education? And he said one of the core components of education for black students has got to entail information about racism, white supremacy, what that is, and how to deal with it. That's got to be one of the core aspects of education for black students. And I'm saying all this as it relates to your book because I think the book that you've authored, The White Architects of Black Education, this book clearly shows that the people who are most responsible for constructing the education that most black people receive, particularly in the South, from the period you study in your book, 1865 to 1964, that was not their objective at all. And I mean informing black people about racism, white supremacy, or doing anything to erode the system of white supremacy, that the white people who constructed black education from that time period, they were dedicated to maintaining racism, white supremacy, getting white people in this area of the world back on the same page after the Civil War, and keeping black people subordinate to white power in this area of the world. And I wanted to check to see if that is accurate, if that would be an accurate summary of the information that you have in this book.
I only wish I could have been as articulate as you just were. Yes, you hit the nail on the head. If I can respond to your remarks, I have three immediate responses. First of all, you brought up Carter G. Woodson, and appropriately so. Carter G. Woodson was clearly one of the inspirations for this work, and Carter G. Woodson helped shape a lot of my thinking, and I wanted to take his excellent work to a deeper level. I wanted to politicize it more and tackle some of the other complexities. So it's very important that we keep Woodson's work, The Miseducation of the Negro, are foremost in our minds as we think about these questions. Secondly, you talk of this educational structure being established often without people even being known, people even knowing that they were being miseducated and misled and bamboozled. You are absolutely right on the money. If the ruling powers can make their rule appear to be natural, then it's a lot easier for them to govern. So they can make it seem as though black folks were supposed to see this subservient education. But this is God's work. This is the way Mother Nature would have it. Then it makes it a lot easier to try to justify an otherwise unjustifiable system. Thirdly, I think it's very important that we understand, and your remarks a moment ago made me think about something, that black education was not education at all. It was training.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to understand the difference between training and education. Education is designed to enlighten, to open your mind, to help you get a grasp on the world and yourself and your place in the world. And education takes up very important issues of justice and liberty and freedom and equality and many of those high and mighty phrases. Training is different. Training is about control. Training is, I want you to do as I say and forget about understanding the world. So black education is clearly falls in the category of training, which is separate from education. And finally, I'm glad that you were able to break bread with my good friend Charles Payne and his wonderful work. Charles lives here in Chicago, and we talk and collaborate often.
I told him when he was on the program on Sunday, I said this will be a nice sequence of programs to have you on following his program where we were also talking about education and racism, that I think it would go nicely. So right on. You talked about, and I thought this was a big theme in your book, and I think a core aspect of the maintenance of racism, white supremacy, or colonialism, making white domination seem organic, natural, ordained by God.
Yeah.
You have a whole chapter. It's actually one of the early chapters in your book devoted to what is called scientific racism. And we've had several programs where we've talked about eugenics and the work of Lothrop Stoddard, Madison Grant, Charles Darwin, Margaret Sanger, and folks who really, you know, kind of hammered out this doctrine of scientific racism, eugenics, and just the devastating global ramifications of this way of thinking. And you talk about how this had a big influence on a lot of the white architects of black education. In fact, on page 40, you wrote that scientific racism was a fundamental precept in the architecture of black education. It was felt that the naturally inferior black must always occupy a socially subservient position. Industrial education, therefore, was right for the blacks, and they for it. More significant, industrial education was presented as progressive reform, After all, wasn't it a step up from slavery? It could be marketed as democracy and a way to increase black participation in the society and the community. Scientific racism provided legitimization for colonial policies. Blacks got all they could intellectually manage. Destiny ordained their place. Can you kind of share your thoughts on how much of an impact this whole doctrine of scientific racism had on the white people who constructed the education that black people received in this area of the world?
Yeah. The movement for scientific racism was primarily a mid-19th century enterprise. Its vestiges lasted long after that. I argue that the scientific racist movement was a precursor to the eugenics movement, which was far more politically influential around the world. But I think you pretty much once again summarized it very capably. Scientific racism was simply the search for no justification, the search for excuses to try to suggest that people of color, especially people of African descent, were somehow genetically inferior. If it could be shown that they were genetically inferior, then they could be relegated to the subhuman category. And any program of containment, control, and management could then be justified because you're dealing with subhuman, people who need to be controlled, people who need to be kept on a leash. And very clearly, the architect of black education embraced many aspects of scientific racism. But beyond that, they also embraced other kinds of, ideas that were patriotic. What sets the black architects apart and just a common Ku Klux Klan to me, is that the white architects took the same ideas that the Klansmen had, but he framed them in a different setting. He framed them in a setting of American patriotism. We want the country to become prosperous. And the country indeed was becoming prosperous. So the white architects were not just the street rabble. They were men with a vision who embraced all of the ugly racism of the time, but they were able to contextualize it and place it in another sense of Christianity, patriotism, and Christian patriotism. So they were a little different than the man on the street, and I wanted to make that distinction. And I think people of power and people who are in powerful positions often have to cultivate very complex layers of theorizing and ideology. But the short answer to the question, yes, they embrace eugenics. Yes, they embrace scientific racism in all of its aspects.
I want to try and touch on just some of the folks who really jumped out at me in reading the book and share that with listeners. And hopefully they'll go get a copy of A White Architects of Black Education. Very informative and, in my opinion, will help you understand some of the things that are even happening today, 21st century, because a lot of these institutions are still around. For starters, Hampton Institute in Virginia, still around. You talk in Chapter 3, General Samuel Chapman Armstrong. I thought this gentleman very important, and I wanted to, if you could share some of his information, just and not just the influence that these folks had in this area of the world, but the education that they constructed to maintain white domination. This was exported all over the world, just on Chapter 43. Talking about, this is General Samuel Chapman Armstrong, that in all parts of the world, in India, in Greece, in Southern Africa, this Hampton idea has been welcomed and imitated. And the pedagogical genius of Armstrong has made him the recognized prophet of education for life. I mean, wow, that is incredible. Can you share a little bit with our listeners about General Armstrong and what he did with the Hampton Institute in Virginia? Professor Watkins, are you with us? Boston, I will attempt to dial him back. Hang tight, everybody. I will call him back right now. If I will, as I'm attempting to dial him back, if you're not able to get through, if you're attempting to call in at Blog Talk Radio, call the other number. I will give that number out in a second, but if you can't get through because the line is kind of full on the Blog Talk end, so if you're not able to get through there, I will give the number as soon as I dial Professor Watkins back. Thank you for your patience. Hopefully I won't have to reload my Skype. We'll cross our fingers and see if it works. Yeah, thank you. Skype did not do me wrong. Okay. Get him back here. And
hello?
Yes, sir. Sorry, I don't know. Don't know what happened there, but we got you back. I was asking about General Armstrong, and
right.
Wanted you to share what he did at the Hampton Institute in Virginia.
Yeah, let me once again introduce a huge subject. Let me say a couple of things. First, parenthetically, by way of introduction, I actually became interested in the white architect while I was studying in West Africa, while I was studying Nigerian education, spending a summer in Nigeria. And my introduction to the white architect came because it was very clear to me that some of the same individuals and institutions who constructed Black education in the United States also constructed colonial education, especially in what they used to call British colonial Africa. So some of the models appeared simultaneously. Some of the models of education in British Africa, I won't speak for Francophone Africa right now. I'm more familiar with Anglophone Africa. Those models were identical. You even have Booker T. Washington schools throughout Black Africa, like the one in Akata in Liberia. And you have a few other Booker T. Washington schools and schools based on that model scattered throughout British tropical Africa. Armstrong, yes, you correctly identified Armstrong as a major player in this whole project. Armstrong was an interesting character. As I try to present in the book, he was the son of missionaries in Hawaii, and the colonial situation in Hawaii was very similar to the situation of blacks in the South. That is, with the indigenous people in Hawaii, there was the indigenous people working sugar cane, as opposed to the enslaved Africans working cotton and also sugar in the United States as well. Armstrong, as a child, became very familiar with the colonial model. His parents were both missionaries and educators. His father, in fact, rose to be a high official in administration in Hawaii. So Armstrong was well-suited for his task, and after college, he fought for the Union Army, and his responsibility in the Union Army was to work with black soldiers. And so while most of the white generals didn't really get to know black or care to know black at all, Armstrong was a rarity. He was, for whatever reasons, again, probably his background, picked up a lot about black culture and considered himself an expert of sorts, as it were, on dealing with black Americans. So following the Civil War, he was assigned to the Freedmen's Bureau, where he worked in the education department, and within a short period of time, within 3 years, founded Hampton Institute. And I, of course, chronicle the whole founding of that school. So Armstrong is the central to our story, one of the central architects of black education. He was the one that developed the idea of accommodationist education. He was the person that understood the deep connection between education and politics and the economy. So he was the right man for the right job, as it were. And we can talk some more specifically about his ideas.
Mm-hmm. You already brought it up. He grew up in Hawaii. His parents were missionaries, and I'm sure that left an indelible print on his mind, influenced his thinking and the work that he did constructing education for black people. On page 51 in your book, you talk about the close tie between Christianity, religion, and the educational institutions that were constructed to ultimately maintain an altered form of racism, white supremacy after the end of formal slavery. On page 51 of your book, you are quoting Charles Brace, who is writing about the work that General Armstrong was doing at the Hampton Institute in Virginia. And you are quoting him, and he says, "Many of the students alluded to their former condition of slavery, but without any tone of reproach or desire for vengeance. And yet there was an expression on their faces which showed that all had felt the iron in the soul," end quotes. "One was pointed out to me, nearly white, who, while a teacher, had been driven from his school into the woods by the Ku Klux, his two assistants being murdered, and he himself barely escaping with his life." He continued, "Not an expression of hostility or ill feeling appeared in any address. Each speaker seemed to feel that the fortunes of his race depended on self-control, virtue, and intelligence of each individual, and that their future was in their own hands. They all apparently deprecated any intruding of themselves socially or of pressing their social rights beyond what was proper and convenient. The most interesting speech of the occasion was made by Joseph Toe, a full-blooded Negro from North Carolina. The speaker described with what eagerness the slaves would work to some of the these cheerful melodies. A peculiar feature of all the addresses was that they closed with a fervent and sincere religious sentiment, for the college is peculiarly a religious seminary." He's talking about the Hampton Institute in Virginia. I wanted you to kind of highlight this peculiar religious seminary and how this ties back into what we were talking about in terms of making white domination seem organic and helping with refining the practice of colonialism or white supremacy.
Okay, wonderful question. Let's talk about Christianity first.
Okay.
And we want to be careful how I phrase some of my response. But it's very clear that early in America's open political development, Christianity and racism became wed and woven together. The many books by Professor Ronald Pataki accurately described the evolution of Christian patriotism and Christian racism. And I won't try to recount all of that work. So Christianity and racism in America has been dovetailed for a long time and remain such. There's a saying that America is most segregated on Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly we see the legacy of apartheid and racism as the white Christians are totally operate exclusive of black Christians and vice versa. So this is part of the design. This is part of the ideological shaping of black education. To make it appear to be natural, ordained by God, and in league with the natural processes that it is, in fact, sanctioned by Scripture, where the Bible talks repeatedly about servant be loyal to your master. And the Bible exhorts folks to accept their plight and look forward to an eternal reward. And again, I should also mention I'm the son of a Pentecostal minister. So many would consider this blaspheme. So I got to put it out there. But anyway, so Christianity, it becomes part of the scheme, becomes part of the training of black folks, becomes part of the ideology of American racism, and the ideology of American capitalism, and colonialism, and imperialism. Everything we do is about God bless America. We never say God bless the world. We say God bless America. And so we word patriotism to religion. And Armstrong was very important in that whole scheme. Secondly, the idea of accommodationist education, which I repeatedly discuss in the book, particularly with respect to Armstrong. The whole notion of accommodationism is a message to people to not rebel. It's telling people don't be disruptive. God, let's try to compromise. Let's try to find ways of where you can hook yourself up by the bootstraps, where you can, it's the purpose of capitalism. And piracy and sobriety, the good things will come to you. So it's woven in to the curriculum, it's woven in to the social ideology of the shaping of Black America. And so I'm saying key in this whole process knowledge of Black folks, with education, with Christianity, with the missionary objective.
Wow. There was some perhaps divine intervention there. There was a little bit of static that popped up, but you're clear now. So we hear your response. But I think that's real important, because when you set up a system in that way, you tie in religion to help enforce your system of injustice. It gives the appearance that if you fight against the system, you're fighting against God. Is an incredibly powerful way to discourage people, particularly the victims, from fighting against or resisting their mistreatment. It just makes it seem like, you know, hey, this is just the natural order of things. God has set this up. Being obedient to us is being obedient to God. It's brilliant. It's brilliant, and it's extremely effective. A lot of my family members seem like your family members. They would be very upset hearing this. I wanted to make sure I touched on Booker T. Washington. I felt this was super important. And not criticizing Booker T. Washington. I definitely feel like he was a victim of racism as well, being mistreated as a black male during this time period. But I felt this was important. He was at the Hampton Institute and carried out a lot of this work. He wasn't opposed to all of this. You have a passage in your book where you're quoting Booker T. Washington's experience at the Hampton Institute in Virginia. And the passage you quote, it says that Booker T. Washington absorbed the philosophy of the program as readily and as eagerly as he adopted the ritual of a daily bath, clean shirts and socks, washed nightly for the wearing next day. The enchantment of a toothbrush, sleeping between sheets, eating on a tablecloth at regular hours, and using a napkin, all of which were startlingly new to him. Almost instantly, he detected a relationship between cleanliness of the body and self-respect, between physical and mental health, and he liked what he discerned. Splashing gleefully in his tub, he knew he had plopped into a way of life suited to his nature. I found that I found it disturbing, but vitally important. Disturbing because it makes it seem like, and I'm sure this is planned by the white architects of black education, it makes it seem like black people, you just caught a tough time because you're so heathen and savage, and if you would just clean yourself up and get things together, things will be all right. All of this really is your fault. You being mistreated and this whole slavery business, it's really your fault. If you could just get your act together and become civilized, things will improve. And I kind of wanted you to comment on, I think it makes the system even more effective if you can get a black spokesperson to come out and endorse this as being, hey, this Hampton Institute is fantastic. This is what we should be doing. Let's not fight against racism, white supremacy, or colonialism. Let's just, you know, let's go cast down your bucket. Let's follow this program. This is going to work out well for us. Do you have thoughts on that?
Stop blaming the victim is the old way. And to try to make people feel that they're responsible for their own oppression. They are somehow deviant. Deviance is a very important part of American sociology, people who deviate from the norm. So this is an old game. And it's a game that has worked pretty well. And it's about turning the tables on people. So I haven't done anything wrong. I'm just little old me. This is me. It's you who doesn't worship God. It's you who is given drunkenness and gambling and licentious behavior. It's you who spend all your money and whatever. And again, as you pointed out, if you take care of yourself, everything will be all right. If you work on your own business and become more like me and adopt my values and get rid of those values that are dragging you down, then you'll be more accessible. Again, it's just more excuses. It doesn't address the crucial problems of racism. It doesn't address the crucial problems of exploitation. It's just more about blaming the victim. And on Booker T, Booker T was very clearly Armstrong's and Hampton's bio student. He clearly loved the Hampton experience. All of his work, all of his autobiography, Working with the Hands, From Slavery, all of his writings are testament to his transformation at Hampton and the embrace of the accommodation of view, and of course his setting of view. So Booker T. Washington becomes important because now he has a black man speaking accommodationism. Say one thing for Armstrong to speak such views, and he can only go so far with black America, because no matter how they perceive him, he's still a white man. And he still is tainted with the practices of the past. But now here's Booker T, one of us, embracing the teaching, celebrating the teaching, and seeing that there's vision and hope and possibility. So Booker T. Washington is teaching the politics of possibility. Yeah, we're a little bit down now. Things are gonna get better. And we're gonna get better along with these things. As America improves, we're gonna improve. And our job is to take care of ourselves and work hard and learn skills and make ourselves ready. It's like the message of, again, the message of Christianity. Make yourself ready for the rapture. Make yourself ready for your Savior. Make yourself ready for that day. And these things have been fostered among black people for hundreds of years. Make yourself ready. And you got to do certain things to get ready. So Booker T. Washington's message was very much like the Christian minister. You got to be born again. You got to shed your sins, and you've got to have an internal. This is all about internal change. Don't worry about the external structure. Handle, take care of yourself, and everything else will take care of itself. Of course, this is all foolishness, but it's a palatable argument. It's an argument that has worked quite well. I should also comment about the rehabilitation of Booker T. Washington. I mean, I thought Booker T. was buried long ago. I thought Du Bois buried him, and so was the black folk. But we see now the resuscitation of Booker T. Washington. It's constantly referred to either by men by people like Bill Cosby and Colin Powell and the new black elite. If you watch them appearing once again, favorably rendered in academic journals and throughout black America, because I find all very, very interesting.
Wow. I want to just check in case, because when you made your final comment about Mr. Booker T. Washington being resuscitated by certain, I think the term used was black elites, such as Colin Powell, Bill Cosby, and others. I thought that was interesting because Booker T. Washington, I think a lot of people are familiar with him. They know a little bit about what he did. Even people that have not spent a lot of time in college, they at least know the name Booker T. Washington. Just if you compare and contrast that with someone like Robert Franklin Williams, who was not around not that long ago, just, you know, 40, 50 years. I mean, he was alive until recently, but really his claim to fame during the Civil Rights Movement, lots of people have no idea who Robert Franklin Williams is at all.
He was on Oprah show, and she didn't really know who he was.
Wow.
I don't know if you ever saw that. It was a remarkable episode in where Oprah is situated on the level of consciousness. But she did have him on there talking about the incident in North Carolina where he rescued the little white children, et cetera, when he was with the NAACP. We didn't have a clue who Robert Williams was beyond that.
Wow. That is incredible.
You ever get a chance, try to look up that episode. When I saw Robert Williams on there, I just couldn't believe it. I almost fell off my chair because Oprah don't go there. Then I found out that 10 minutes later, he didn't have a clue who he was. He never didn't know nothing about Negroes were done. Didn't know anything about what he had done and his international stature. Check that out.
Wow. Wow. I hope everyone listening, look for the episode with Robert F. Williams on the Oprah Winfrey Show. I mean,
yeah, 4 years back. Of course, you know, before he passed.
Wow. Oh, now that... Now, I really want you to compare that. The number, we just did a whole program on Negroes with guns.
Uh-huh.
There were tons of people who emailed me and said they'd never heard of Robert F. Williams, didn't know anything about him. Now, I just want you all to think about that. The number of people who have no idea who Robert F. Williams is, and this is someone who was on the Oprah Winfrey Show, compared to Booker T. Washington, who died almost 100 years ago. And how many people know who that is, or at least could tell you a little bit about, oh, okay, yeah, Booker T. Washington, cast down your buckets, yeah, yeah, yeah. Just think about that and then think, why is that the case? Why do you know who Booker T. Washington is? He died almost 100 years ago, but you don't know who Robert F. Williams is. And apparently Oprah Winfrey didn't either. She was on her show. I mean, just think about that.
Yeah, he's been erased, not only the history books, but from our consciousness, unless you go after that information, you're right. We've been erased from the general awareness of the general public.
Wow. Our guest for today's program, Professor William Watkins, author of The White Architects of Black Education. If I can't find it, if somebody out there does find it, you can shoot me an email if you find that episode of Robert F. Williams on the Oprah Winfrey Show. I want to check out Justice if she has some more questions. I did want to ask just because you're giving out such fantastic information, if the static continues, would it be possible if it does continue just for backup, if there is either a landline or a different number that I could dial you on in case the static continues, would it be possible for you to email me a separate number in case that continues so we have another way of connecting?
It's overwhelming here. Let me switch now. Hold on.
Okay.
Is this better?
Oh, that is better.
Okay. I've just switched to a landline.
Okay. Outstanding. That we should be good to go then.
Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't realize the static was so significant.
Okay. You're crystal clear now. We're all good.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. You should have told me earlier.
It was coming intermittently. You were fine, and then it would come in. It would come in at key points, like when you made a point about Christianity, a little bit of static came, and then when you made a point about Booker T. Washington being brought up by Bill Cosby and Colin Powell, then a little bit of static came in. So.
Okay.
But, yeah, we should be good now. Justice, if you have some questions you would like to ask Professor Watkins, please go right ahead. Wait a minute. I got to get your line back. Sorry about that. Okay. If you got questions, please go right ahead, Justice.
Mr. Watkins, education is important. How is education important, and why is education important to you?
Well, I mean, education gives us a sense of the world. It gives us a sense of who we are in the world and what the world is about and where the world has come from, where we've come from. Education is, I don't know that there's anything more valuable than having knowledge of the circumstances in which we exist. Our society, I think, is we're experiencing a real anti-intellectual trend in our society, and that's because knowledge is dangerous. Ideas are dangerous. Knowledge is powerful, and ideas are powerful. And people's quest for liberation begins with ideas. Everything begins with an idea. So our education is absolutely critical to how we conduct ourselves and what we do with our lives. In America, the popular culture in America attempts to foster self-indulgence. That is, you're a consumer, you are an individual agent, your job is to buy stuff, and just, you know, live in your own world and improve and advance yourself. That's kind of the collective cultural ideology of America. And that's very antithetical to what Du Bois was talking about in the education, especially the education of black people. And that is knowing what's going on and knowing what we have to do and how we have to organize and how we have to think and how we have to, what Du Bois said is we can take advantage of these people who are drunk with their own arrogance to push them aside. But we've got to be educated and we've got to know who we are and what we're doing and how and why we need to get together. So education is important at many levels, collectively for our people and for our plight, and individually for our own roundedness and our own understanding of who we are. So I'm big on education. I'm big on the power of ideas.
What are some constructive ways of how to talk to non-white children, particularly black children, in education without getting them upset?
Without getting them upset? Is that what you said? Without getting them upset?
But talking about, like, race and white supremacy in education without getting them upset.
Well, I don't know that you... I think if you talk about it in a meaningful way, I don't see any problem with getting upset. I know in the 21st century we're supposed to not antagonize our children and not antagonize other people. We're supposed to just do happy talk. And we all get along. But sometimes we have to abandon happy talk and tell the truth. And the truth is not always pleasant, and the truth is upsetting. And I think children should be constructively, should experience some cognitive dissonance. And that is some reevaluation and some confusion and have previous beliefs challenged and be taught how to think. Again, this is the genius of Du Bois. this is the pedagogy of Du Bois, that that ideas can help us change the world. So if people get upset about that, so be it, as long as we move in a constructive way.
Why do white people keep information from non-white people?
Okay, I'm having a little bit of static. If you could repeat that for me.
Why do white people keep information from non-white people?
Why do white people keep information from non-white people? Well, the white people who control the means of information are actually threatened by certain knowledge. Because we have in the book, in chapter 1, I talk about the selection of knowledge. They're very careful about what knowledge they select to pass on. And not all knowledge gets passed on. Only the knowledge that legitimizes their place. And so the information that's passed on in schools is the knowledge of European society and the European model of culture and civilization. So the knowledge of ancient civilizations, of the ancient African civilizations, of the great Aztec and Mayan civilizations, the great Han civilization of China. This all becomes illegitimate knowledge. And people never, at least if they stay within the confines of the traditional education system, they may never learn about other people, other deeds, other paradigms, other art, other culture, other music, other literature. There's a concerted effort to select knowledge, and in the case of what's going on today in Texas, to even rewrite the textbooks as they are doing, and to try to, I don't know what they're turning to in Texas. They're relying on mythology and sophistry and Lord only knows what, but it has almost nothing to do with legitimate knowledge. So yeah, knowledge is everything. Knowledge is power.
Where can non-white people go for help when they find the white people telling false information to them?
Well, that's a good question. We have to knowledge is obscured from us. It's hidden. You're not going to get it on TV. You're not going to get it in these churches. And you're not going to get it in schools. That is the question of the day. Where do we go to learn what's really going down? And it's becoming harder and harder to find such venues because the people in charge don't want the true story to be known. So people have to strike out on their own. People have to read on their own. That's an extremely important question. And it's not always easily answered. I wish I had a better answer for you. I know that the folks that I try to work with do everything we can to write, to talk, to participate with the community, to teach in progressive teaching environments. And so for the time being, we're going to have to rely on the few truth tellers that we have amongst us and hopefully spread the good news.
Mr. Watkins, why do you think some non-white children think that education is not always fun?
saying education is not always fun?
Yes.
Because of what these schools are doing now, they've become so bureaucratic and they've become so boring and tedious that they're turning children off of knowledge. They're alienating children. They've become irrelevant. They are not engaging children. They're, again, talking about a body of ideas that are outside the universe of children and that children don't care about. And plus, many non-white children don't see the rewards, you know, from education. And all the data we're getting suggests that there's no correlation between a happy life and a lot of education. And there's also a lessening correlation between prosperity and education. So if children aren't seeing the payoff and it's not exciting, why buy into it? I spent a lot of time in school, and a lot of the kids are just totally turned off. And even the adults that have gone through the education, when I talk to my friends of mine, did not pursue higher education, I find that they don't read books. I find that they don't go to lectures. I find that their minds have gone on hiatus, and they're sitting there in front of the idiot box, and they're doing all kinds of unhealthy intellectual pursuits. So those of us who are teachers and those of us who care got a whale of a task ahead of us. I don't know we're going to have to, I don't know that we can work even within the schools as they're currently structured. That's why the school bureaucracies are doing so much to guarantee that education will remain stale and Eurocentric, and task-oriented, and irrelevant. By passing these laws like No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top, this stuff is absolutely absurd. Don't let me get on my soapbox.
That will be all for now.
Thank you.
Context of white supremacy, I want to give the number out. If you want to call in, you cannot call in at Blog Talk Radio, I don't think, because the lines are way, way full. But you can call in at the 760-569-7676, and the code is 948-656. You can call in there if you just want to listen or if you want to ask questions. Number again is 760-569-7676, and the code is 948-656. Give me a hot couple minutes, and I will go to the phone line. Really important, just so many black people that I know who are, I'll say, 40 and under. Hip-hop has a big hold on them. They are huge Jay-Z fans, and I look at that and say, wow. The white architects of black education have done a phenomenal job in confusing black people, that we see a black person who decided to name his company after the Rockefeller family. That is astounding. I wanted to make sure I shared some of the information about the Rockefellers, who were architects of black education. I guess number one, to make sure I started, Spelman College in Atlanta is named after John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s maternal grandmother.
Laura Spelman Rockefeller.
Okay, so I guess that would be number one, HBCU in Atlanta. And then This is on page 122 of your book, sir. You're writing about John D. Rockefeller, Jr. You write, thus, the historically black college became a cause célèbre for John D. Rockefeller, Jr. He would lend his name to the United Negro College Fund and present numerous speeches at Hampton, Fisk, Spelman, Tuskegee, and other schools. All of those are HBCUs, by the way, historically black colleges and universities. For him, the black college would properly establish the Negro's place in the new social and industrial order. At one speech before the United Negro College Fund, he remarked, "We of the right of the white race owe a debt of gratitude to our fellow citizens of the Negro race for having conceived and brought into being the idea of the educational chest, the value of which is so generally recognized. As a sponsor of ideas, John D. Rockefeller Jr. knew full well of the black of the black America's key socioeconomic importance. For big business to operate effectively, an orderly South had to be maintained, a contained black populace providing cheap labor was a key ingredient to an orderly South." I just want to read that sentence again for emphasis. "A contained black populace providing cheap labor was a key ingredient to an orderly South." Political advisors William Baldwin, a railroad man who employed thousands of Southern blacks, and banker Robert Ogden had written and spoken about black labor. John D. Rockefeller Jr. was well briefed on the desirability of cheap labor for the economy. And I mean, with the Rockefellers, this is not just what they did here. We're talking about a global influence of this family. You want to look at so-called apartheid in South Africa. The Rockefellers did quite a bit of work there as well. Professor Watkins, I guess if you could share some of the information about the Rockefellers and their influence and work in constructing black educational institutions.
Well, you got us off to a good start. I mean, clearly they're the best known of the families and individuals I looked at. Their name is synonymous with big wealth, big cash, big banking, big industrialization. One wonders why they committed so much of their effort and time and money to black education. Of course, that drew my interest. Here are these people building a worldwide empire, the wealthiest family that humanity has ever seen. Even the kings in feudal times, didn't have the kind of dough that the Rockefeller family was accumulating. And given the sweep of their financial empire, why bother? Why spend so much time? And they spent considerable time on black education. Well, very clearly, it tells me they understood the importance of black folks, of managing black folks, of, again, controlling black folks. All of these people saw the management and control of black folks as an important ingredient to the ongoing prosperity and expansion of American business and capitalism. So the Rockefellers were knee-deep. Their role with the General Education Board is absolutely unprecedented. An act of Congress set up the General Education Board with unprecedented governance power over black education in the South, and the Rockefeller family was put in charge of the charter of the GEB. I mean, that is absolutely insane that you're going to put a family in charge of the education of millions of black folks. a private family over and above the legal system. So the General Education Board is very important in this overall story I'm trying to tell as an example of control and power and racism. And other than that, I mean, we know, everyone knows who the Rockefellers were and who they are. We all know about Chase Manhattan Bank, and we all know that they have been, for the last 150 years, the most powerful and wealthy family in the nation. Need I say more?
I just wanted to make sure we included some of their, I guess, key advisors. Dr. Wallace Buttrick, he was a member of the General Education Board, and I guess he ran with the Rockefeller Klan at that time period. This is on page 126. You're quoting a different individual about Mr. Buttrick. The historians have revealed only a half-truth in arguing that it was the white South that insisted on a second-class education to prepare blacks for subordinate roles in the Southern economy. I make sure I read that one two times just for emphasis. Historians have revealed only a half-truth in arguing that it was the white South that insisted on a second-class education to prepare blacks for subordinate roles in the Southern economy. The Northern philanthropists insisted on the same. White supremacists themselves, Northern reformers, were not perturbed by the Southern racism per se. They also viewed black Americans as an inferior and childlike people. Peabody maintained that black people were children in mental capacity. Likewise, Southern Education Board and General Education Board trustee Wallace Buttrick said, "I recognize the fact that the Negro is an inferior race and the Anglo-Saxon is the superior race." Ogden also spoke of the black man's childish characteristics and argued that blacks were thriftless, careless, shiftless, and idle by disposition. And I guess my icing on the cake would be you continue on page 127 writing that Buttrick consistently recommended that funding should be provided only for black schools that offered the true education of the Negroes, that is, manual, industrial, and agricultural training. I wanted you to talk about that. When you have the ability, when you are financing these institutions and the Rockefellers' monstrous financial power, when you are financing an institution, that gives you incredible ability to impact what the curriculum for that particular academic institution is going to be. And these, I mean, clearly, explicitly saying, we want these schools to be such that they will support a cheap manual labor market for black people. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, well, very clearly, he who pays the piper calls the tune. I mean, education's a terribly expensive proposition. And while there were many, many efforts to set up schools independent of the white architects, independent of the accommodationist philosophy, sooner or later, to get money, you had to go to these people. I mean, they had airtight control over the funds. And just like today, to set up independent education, despite the desires of many, many people to have black schools and independent schools, and there are some that exist. It's extremely difficult because people got to be paid. Teachers got to be paid. You got to put heat in the buildings. You got to feed kids. It's not a cheap proposition. It's very difficult, and that's why it's left to the government who levies taxes, and it's a multi-gazillion dollar industry. So, yes, these folks had a chokehold because they control the money, and you got to go to them when you want to write a proposal for some sort of project, education project. You had to go to people like Thomas Jesse Jones, and you had to go to these other white architects. Case in point about the kind of power they exerted, late in Du Bois' life, after he was done with the NAACP, done with the crisis, you'll recall he went back to Atlanta University to continue his work on the Black Encyclopedia and to continue to try to train men of color, as he put it. It was actually the Rockefellers who instructed one of the deans at Atlanta University to get the roster of students who enrolled in Du Bois' class and to call those students in and discourage them from taking the class.
Wow.
And to actually tell them, you don't want to take this old man's class, and if you do, it's going to be a mark against you. I mean, the Rockefeller family at the top level actually went to that extent to oppose independent thinking and to oppose the great Dr. Du Bois. And that shows you how these people not only managed at the top money, but they even micromanaged when necessary to protect their vested interests and to protect the model of colonial education that they were shaping, and to protect the tenets and integrity of colonial education to the detriment of Black folks. So these are not passive people who maintain, they're not distant. These folks were involved in the nitty-gritty funding and choosing of the curriculum and managing. They didn't leave anything to chance.
Wow. Again, our guest for today's program, Professor William Watkins, and you can check his website if you go to WilliamHWatkins.com. Again, that is WilliamHWatkins.com. You can check out the other books that he's done, get more information about our guest for today's program. I had two final questions, then I want to check the phone lines because quite a few folks have called in. If you would like to call to listen or to ask questions, the number you can dial again is 760-569-7676, and the code is 948-656. Given, you know, all of the just incredible information that you have shared, particularly funding, and you have folks, the Rockefellers and people who are on the General Board of Education who are saying, if these schools are not operating in a manner that we agree with and operating in a manner to maintain the racial stratification, what I labeled the system of racism, white supremacy, we're not going to give them a dollar. In my view, it should be no surprise when you learn about the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. This happened at a historically Black college and university. That should not be a surprise at all when you understand that white architects totally control and dominate these institutions. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's you've connected the dots very nicely. I mean, that's one of the most horrific acts in the annals of experimental science, not only in this country, but throughout the world. That's a shameful episode in American history.
Mm. Wow.
And yes, it took place at Tuskegee, I mean, of all places.
I'm just sharing, I think one of the one of the lowest spots for me. And when I began studying racism, white supremacy, I bumped into a black female. She was a student, or she might still be a student at an HBCU, and she spent a lot of time, she had a lot of pride about, you know, being at this HBCU, and she said that they really emphasize history and, you know, studying, you know, the whole legacy of historically black colleges and universities. And I said, oh, okay, that's, you know, that's great. I'm glad to hear that. Do you know about the syphilis study? And she said, no, what are you talking about? And I put my own talking before I'm done with the conversation. And I just said, wow, this is, wow, HBCUs in the 21st century, wow.
Well, we need to say one thing. I don't want to, you know, I really want to be balanced as we talk about the HBCUs, because they were very necessary and they did help educate a large number of people who perhaps otherwise would not have gotten any education.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were not irrelevant, nor are they irrelevant today, even though blacks can go to white colleges. I think they played a role in the interest of. At the same time, it should also be noted that the HBCUs are bastions of, shall we say, social conservatism, not political conservatism, but social conservatism. I think Spike Lee captured it very well in his movie School Days.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think was his best film, and he looked at the tensions taking place at a black college between those brothers and sisters who wanted to be involved and be a part of the anti-apartheid struggle and be radical and protest and spread consciousness, as opposed to the others who wanted to dance, shuffle, and shake their booty. And so we see the HBCUs remain, even to this day, very conservative at Morehouse. The brothers have to go to chapel, 6 days a week, and are taught, imbued with Gandhian views and the views of what's left of accommodationism. And I don't think they're learning a whole lot about Robert Williams.
Wow. I was just going to throw in, I think Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man also does a pretty good job of articulating a lot of the experiences, pros and cons, of HBCUs. Okay. My last question I was going to toss out. Have you seen the more? It's a recent article about the. I'll set it up this way. On page 176, you were writing. This is in the chapter on J.L.M. Curry. You wrote the ultimate apocalypse for Curry was Negro dominance. Whites should never allow blacks to evolve to that political posture. A solid Negro vote, he argued, could emasculate, in quotes, the white South. Divine law, in his view, dictated white rule. Just, man, really profound paragraph, and particularly the word emasculate. I mean, the long history of castration, and even in this book, there's a lot of talk of black people being children, and they're not adults, they're not civilized, they're boys and girls. Did you see the recent article? It was titled The Mean Girls of Morehouse, and it was talking about the cross-dressing and effeminate homosexual behavior of some of the black male students at Morehouse.
I did not. Where was that published?
It was published in Vibe magazine, but it's online. I can send you a link, but it has.
I would like, yeah, please.
I will get that to you as soon as the program ends.
No, I haven't seen that.
It just came out a couple weeks ago. I'm trying to get the author of that piece to come on the program, but wow. I looked at that article, and when I read this, I immediately thought of that article, and I thought, just attempting to connect the dots, I could be incorrect. I see the fingerprints of those white architects, in my view, racist, white supremacist architects. I see the fingerprints of their work and really the continuation of their work when I see reports like that that are showing effeminate, castrated, emasculated black males at Morehouse College who are on, and they have huge photographs of these black males who are students there who are wearing women's clothing, cross-dressing, and things of that nature. Does that sound logical, or am I not making sense?
Well, I know that there's some gender changes taking place in our society. I don't know the extent of it. I know that there's a lot of talk here in Chicago, even at the high school level, about, shall we call it, gender bending.
Mm.
I don't know what else to call it. That's not an area I spend a lot of time researching, but a bit surprised. Were these black males that cross-dressed, was it a part of some celebration, or was it Halloween, or fraternity hijinks? I'm trying to get at what it was.
They, you know, just said this is them. This is their identity. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a prank to my knowledge. It was reported as though this is just they are honestly interested in wearing females' clothing, or some of them are so-called homosexual, or at least they enjoy the cross-dressing aspect. It wasn't, you know, a prank. It wasn't a hazing process for a fraternity. In fact, there was a CNN. They had a pretty major report last October where at Morehouse they had to institute these new rules, and a part of the rules was they were saying you couldn't cross-dress. Apparently it had gotten, you know, to the point where they felt they needed to make some rules to
really?
To stop this behavior. Yes, sir.
No, this is I'm a little bit behind on this. I know there's a lot of cultural changes happening in the sexual arena. This has eluded me. I don't generally read Vibe magazine. I think the lowest I get is Jet. I refuse to go beyond Jet, but I see I'm gonna have to read a little deeper and broader to stay abreast of some of this stuff.
I understood.
Yeah, please send that to me. I'd like to see that.
Yes, sir. I will send it to you immediately. But it just that article seemed a long, long way from Robert Franklin Williams.
Yes, I would say so.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to hit the phone line if that's acceptable with you.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Individual that called in, number is block number. If you have a hand up from a block number, your line should be open.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Loud and clear. Yes, ma'am.
Good evening to you, Brother Gus. Good evening to Justice. And, of course, good evening to the doctor.
Thank you. Good evening to you as well.
Okay, sir, I'm so glad that you're having this discussion. I'm a native Atlantan, and all of the things that you were mentioning in this study, as well as the names that you have been calling up, it is bringing very clear to me. As well as, do you remember the Rosenthal School? Have you
yes,
ever been
Rosenthal
any, you know,
School,
work on those that were started right after the Civil War ended for the freed slaves?
Oh, absolutely. Julius Rosenthal, that was serious Roebuck money.
Correct, which is what I
yes.
wanted to tie in, because when you were mentioning about the school system and how it was set up predominantly to keep us as enslaved people, to keep us still working for the masses, it was started way, as you said, way back in those times. And that is one of the reasons why Morris Brown College here in Atlanta that lost its accreditation, and they are not going to try and give Morris Brown its accreditation back, because there are very few schools within the HBCU that were actually started by former slaves. And Morris Brown is one of them. Of course, we know about Bethune-Cookman and, of course, a few others that are out there. But the vast majority of these HBCUs were started and named after former Civil War veterans who decided to open these schools, like Howard University. We like to give them a lot of props. But Howard University was primarily started for the biracial children of these so-called people in Congress in order to put to educate their children. They had Georgetown, so of course they went ahead and opened Howard, who was named after a Civil War general.
Yeah.
Then you're then of course we come up now to Dr. William Leon Hansberry. I'm sure you're well aware of Dr. Hansberry, who was a teacher at Howard University. Are you aware of him?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Remember how he was treated. He was not allowed to get to give him grant money to go to pursue his studies. He was, and it came out of the same Rockefeller Foundation. They were the ones who blocked him when he was trying to pursue get his studies in antiquity. The same thing can also be said for quite a few others, and we can go on and on. Dr. Eric Williams, who was the late premier for Trinidad and Tobago, he also got his start at Howard University. And I was fortunate.
Right, he wrote Capitalism and Slavery, one of my favorite books.
Correct. I have quite a few of his books in my collection. So these
yes.
are lots of good men, that, and they've all left disillusioned. The late, great Dr. Asa Hillier, he used to teach at Clark Atlanta, and all of these instructors have left from these historically black schools, because they came to the realization that these schools, they have this name and this image in place in front of them, but they are not teaching, they're trying to indoctrinate these students to be just like their counterpart in the white community. They are not doing anything for them. The majority of the teachers that you find at these institutions, especially if you go to Howard, they are white Jewish instructors that are there teaching our children. So we might put a black face on these universities and schools, but the curriculum that we are being taught is just as if we would have taken our children from there and put them into one of these white institutions. They're getting the same education.
You get no argument from me.
Let's see. Person who called in. Okay, person who called in. This is Mr. Nero. Mr. Nero, did you have a question for Professor Watkin?
I'm sorry, Gus. I really couldn't hear much of the broadcast. I'll have to go back and listen to the archives. I don't know if it was maybe something on my end, but I just couldn't hear most of it clearly. So, no, I don't have any questions at this time.
Oh, thank you, sir. Appreciate it. See, person who called in, last four digits, 3413. 3413, did you have a question?
No.
Can you turn your radio down? We're echoing. Can you turn your radio down?
Yeah, I don't have the radio on.
Okay.
I'm just listening. I'm enjoying the show. So thank you.
Oh, good. Thank you for calling in. Different person who called in from a block number. Did you have a question?
Hello?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Oh, greetings. Professor Watkins, something that you said that stuck with me. And the caller that was speaking, the female that was speaking earlier, kind of alluded to what I'm going to be talking about, is that what you said is that the students can't see any gain. I mean, they don't have, you know, you can't say if you go to college you're going to get a job or what. And I was thinking that we had a lot of black intellectuals, you know, Booker T. Washington, and you mentioned Du Bois and whatnot. I was thinking, do you think that the key missing ingredient was that they weren't taught white supremacy, they wasn't taught about racism, white supremacy, that is the very thing that is not being taught, and it is the only thing that, you know, that's the focus, that the focus should be teaching about reality and the system that we're living in.
Well, I mean, certainly I agree that I was a high school teacher for 10 years. It's a very complex situation. Yes, on the one hand, you're absolutely correct. The curriculum has been largely irrelevant. When I had to customize all of my teaching because I wasn't with what was in the textbooks. And I wanted to teach about black folks, and I wanted to teach about protests, and I wanted to teach about revolution, and I wanted to teach the things I wanted to share. So that was part of it. The other part of it is truly we're seeing that for black college graduates, there's no big reward at the end of the tunnel. There's no big rainbow. There's no pot of gold.
Right.
And the hoped for riches don't exist. And some people come to that abrupt reality. And I think young kids come to it very quickly because they see what's going on in the communities. And they see that their desires for a better life aren't always meshed with higher education. So it's a very complex problem. You know, the problem operates at many layers. And so the thing that, I mean, certain parts of this week, we can't always control the labor market. But those of us who are teachers and those of us who are care can certainly guarantee some good teaching. We can do that much.
Oh, Gus, can you hear me still?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Oh, I just wanted to say, Professor, that I really enjoyed the show and the information. For some reason, I have an affinity for, I don't know, hearing black males and when you know, giving information about, you know, time periods and whatnot. So I just wanted to say I really enjoyed this show in particular. And if you come back and, you know, talk about how you were raised, I mean, what was it that was told to you by your parents that got you to read, to be an intellectual?
Ooh, I get asked that question so often, and I hate to deal with the question because I really don't know how to answer. I was brought up in the Pentecostal church, and I was brought up by traditionally poor black folks. And when I say traditional, I mean we didn't have many worldly interests. Our answer was church. Because when you're in a Pentecostal church, you go to church, and more church. And so I don't have any, there's no great epiphany in my life. I just was a very average dude in a very average environment. And I grew up at a time when there was the raising of consciousness, the Black Power movement, which was collapsed with the anti-war movement. And so for me, as an individual, I was just, it was the times that helped shape me. I had I was raised by a praying grandmother, just like the rest of us. And so there was nothing that really, again, there's no one event or one series of events. I just had good, regular people and raised in a very average, very traditional black family. Well, that's my story.
Thank you, 909. Different person who called in from a block. Do you have a question? Different person from a block number?
Is that me?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Good evening. I'd like to ask the guest, just based on what you just said, I'm curious because I spend a lot of time growing up in a Pentecostal church as well. And I'm curious, coming up during the time of the Black Power movement, what was the typical reaction or tenor among people in the Pentecostal church to that movement and that ideology that, you know, be black and proud, black is beautiful, et cetera?
Oh, I think the church didn't connect with that at all.
Wow.
I should add that I was put out of the church during that time. I think the church tried to maintain its own integrity, its own direction. At least, now some of the churches, I think, adjusted and tried to become more modern and tried to connect to what was going on in their times. And those churches got larger. Some of them are now mega churches. Some of the Pentecostal churches remained, shall we say, sectarian. At least the church I belong to, which was a split off from Kojic, never connected with the Black Power movement, never connected with radical or revolutionary politics, and that's why they no longer had need for my services.
So did they look at Black Power anything, I guess you would say, African-centered or race-centered as something negative or against God?
You know, there were a lot of churches that did get involved. I mean, there was, you know, I'm thinking of Reverend Klieg in Detroit, and I'm thinking of some of the pastors that became really leaders in the movement. And I don't want to overlook them by any means, but you asked me about my own particular church. No, they just saw the Black Power movement as irrelevant. I don't think they put it down, nor did they praise it. They just went on stepping with their own agenda.
Okay.
We never had discussions of social issues in my church.
And that's what I think is part of the problem in the Black churches today, honestly, is that is not discussed, but prosperity and mysticism and things of that nature are, and I think that retards us as a people.
Oh yeah, we can do a whole year's worth of shows on the Black church and the prosperity gospel. And here in Chicago, we got a belly full of it. And I don't know where you are, but I know in many cities, this is a new disease that is contagious.
The blog you can check out for 818, the blog, ebonynewschannel.blogspot.com. A person who called in 8586, did you have a question?
Yes, how you doing, Brother Gus? Dr. Block.
Can you speak up a little bit, sir?
Yeah, I cannot hear the caller.
I'm sorry, can you hear me now?
Yes.
I just want to say, how you doing, everybody? And I had a question for the doctor. I wanted to know, can you share your thoughts on the relationship, if you know, about the relationship between W.E.B. Du Bois and the great Marcus Garvey?
I'm sorry, Gus, I'm not hearing the question. If you could repeat it for me.
He said, if you have information, could you talk about the relationship between Dr. Dubois and Marcus Messiah Garvey?
Oh, yeah. That's in the book. I'm not sure I do it in this book or another book. But, yeah, I got a whole bibliography of the discussions back and forth between the two. I can refer you to the Crisis magazine. Du Bois attacked Marcus Garvey in the middle of the crisis. I can't give you the exact edition off the top of my head, but it's in the crisis. They had a horrible back-and-forth relationship with ugly name-calling. Very, very ugly name-calling. So the crisis is one source. I think Garvey wrote some things in The Messenger that were not very flattering about Du Bois. I mean, they actually, Du Bois talked about, call him like a little black fool with thick lips. I mean, it got ad hominem and personal. And Garvey talked about Du Bois running around with white women. So, yeah, that stuff is, it's all documented.
Is that, I didn't see that in this book. Is that in one of the other?
No, it's not. It's not in this book. It's in some of my other writings, but I didn't address the Du Bois Garvey debates at all in this particular book. but I've addressed it elsewhere.
Okay. That might be, if you're interested in coming back to chat, I'm sure folks would appreciate the chance to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's, oh yeah, that stuff is very well known.
Okay. Justice, you had a few more questions before we wrap up. Justice, if you had some other questions you wanted to ask, please feel free.
What are some of the best ways you can think of for black students to fight back when white people mistreat them in a predominantly white school?
The best way for black students to fight back against white students in a predominantly white school? I'm just trying to get clear on the question. Justice, could you run that by me one more time?
So, say the question one more time?
Please.
Okay. What are some of the best ways you can think of for black students to fight back when white people mistreat them in a predominantly white school?
Okay, I got you. That's a deep question, and it's a real question, because there are black folks in, not only in higher education, especially in higher education, but also in some of these suburban schools and throughout the country. It's a real, real question where a small minority of black students are under assault, name-calling, ridicule. I don't have a great answer, except that, I mean, we have to stand up for who we are. I'm not advocating that we cave in, nor am I advocating that we get too crazy when we're outnumbered. But we have to, you know, put on our thinking cap. We have to certainly band together and try to dispel some of the whatever comes at us. I mean, these are real problems. I know a lot of colleges are now experiencing blackface skits that take place when there's just a handful of black students, and they'll make fun of them doing blackface skits. And it's real, real tough. What are the black students to do? I wish I had something handy. I mean, it's one thing to say you can call on the administration. They may or may not help you. But the main thing is we have to band together and stand up for what's right and stand up for our rights.
If you have offspring, how do you help your offspring understand, learn and understand racism, white supremacy?
I didn't hear the last thing you said. I have offspring. How do I help them understand?
Mr. Watkins, if you have offspring, how do you help your offspring learn and understand racism, white supremacy?
Well, I do have offspring. In fact, I'm even a grandfather. So, yes, I'm constantly trying to educate my own people, as well as my students, as well as anybody I can talk to about racism and about the history of our people. Again, I'm excited about knowledge. I'm excited about the world, as harsh and as cruel and oppressive as it is. I know that we have the capacity to organize. I know that we have the capacity to conceptualize a better world. I know a better world possible. So as a teacher, I want to draw on that enthusiasm. I want to draw on the vision. I want to draw on knowledge. And I want to use knowledge to enthuse other people about possibility, about, you know, where we can go, about the evils of racism and other issues that we're confronted with. So my final remarks is that I'm excited about possibility. I'm excited about ideas. I'm excited to be a teacher. And I'm excited about the world, and I hope to be a part of the new world. I hope to be a part of the solution and not the problem.
Do you think being on this show helped you replace white supremacy with justice? If so, how?
I hope so. I mean, white supremacy hides. White supremacy is strengthened when it is cloaked in secrecy and uncertainty. And I see my job as one of speaking truth to power, speaking truth to whoever I can, where I can. And I think white supremacy is a lie that can't live forever. Most lies have to die at some point. And I want to participate in the burial of white supremacy and colonialism and exploitation and the oppression of people. So I'm hoping, and I do a lot of radio interviews and I do a lot of writing, and I'm just trying to make my own little contribution in my own small way.
What do you mean when you say colonialism?
The conquest of people of color by powerful white countries and nations and people. I think I'm not going to have time to give a full definition of colonialism. But it's the establishment of privilege, the conquest of other people, and the benefiting off the backs of other people, whether it's their labor, their resources, whatever. It's a relationship of advantage and privilege exercised by one group over another. That's a short definition for you.
It was a pleasure having you on the couch today, and have a great time with the rest of your day.
Well, thank you so very much for your questions, and thank you for having me.
Yep.
Context of white supremacy. The website, again, where you can check out more information for Professor Watkins is WilliamHWatkins.com. One more time, that is WilliamHWatkins.com. If you're listening to the archives at Blog Talk Radio, you can just click his name and that'll take you right to his website. It was a real privilege to have you on the program and to read your book. I learned a ton. I hope people will get a copy. The White Architects of Black Education, Ideology and Power in America, 1865 to 1954. Phenomenal read. Professor Watkins, I thoroughly enjoyed the program. I hope it was a constructive use of your Tuesday evening, and we would definitely love to have you back on the program if you're interested.
I'd love to come back, and thank you very much for having me.
Outstanding. Again, our guest this evening, Professor William H. Watkins, joining us live from Chicago. Thank you so much for speaking with us, and I hope you have a phenomenal Tuesday evening. And you already have that article, the Vibe article. I already emailed it to you, so check your email, and you can see what's going on at Morehouse.
Thank you so much.
Yes, sir. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Context of white supremacy. We're going to take a quick commercial break and come right back. If you have any comments that you would like to share, I'll give folks a bit of time. We have a lot of folks that called in. Quick commercial, and we will be right back. Justice can share any thoughts she has as well. Context of white supremacy.
performances in honor of Black History Month, the first African insurrection musical in history is coming to Washington, D.C. That's right, One Horizon, in conjunction with Kamasi Industries, is bringing them Memphis Boys, Brothers Keepers, to Washington, D.C. to do their nationally acclaimed play, 1831 Turner Street, on the life and times of the prophet Nat Turner. 1831 Turner Street is a place set in the modern climate of Black America. An elder meets a young brother and sister who are headed in the wrong direction. He steps in and provides parental guidance by teaching them about the life and times of Nat Turner the prophet. Black family, you'll laugh, cry, sing, and dance throughout the entire production. This place where the entire Black family, adults and children alike, have agreed that this is the single best production they've ever seen live. 1831 Turner Street will be in Washington, D.C. on Sunday, February 20th, 2011, at the brand new R Theater.
If you said you could only charge one
thing. D.C. need your financial support. We're trying to raise $10,000 by January 31st, 2011. Any amount you are able to give will be applauded. Donations in the following increments will be accompanied by a gift of appreciation. $50 to $99, part one of the Feminization of the Black Male series, our most popular DVD lecture on the condition of the Black male worldwide. $100 to $199, entertainment, fighting the poltergeist, a three-disc DVD set.
One hour of shocking information
on the influence of Western media. $200 and up, the War of the Horizon collection series, an eight-disc DVD set which contains the entire effeminization and white sex series and more. To make your contribution, you can mail a check or money order to War on the Horizon, P.O. Box 54501, Washington, D.C., 20032-9101. You can call us toll-free at 877-927-0011 or 202-309-9106 to make a credit card donation by phone. You may also go to our website homepage, waronthehorizon.com/site, and click on the donate button at the bottom of the page to make a contribution via PayPal using your PayPal account, your credit card, or bank draft. For more information, you can look us up on Facebook under War on the Horizon. Black people, remember, at War on the Horizon, we didn't come here to be your friend. We came here to save you, and we look forward to seeing you on the battlefield. War on the Horizon, gotta love you.
Context of white supremacy.
Woo!
Gusty Renegade and Justice. I hope you all enjoyed the program. My fault. Well, actually, it wasn't my fault, but I will say the first, I guess, 50 minutes or so of the broadcast, I'm not sure. Maybe he was speaking on speakerphone, but I think it made it difficult for some people to clearly understand him. I could understand him on this end, and I suspect when you listen to the archives, it'll be a little easier to understand him. I would highly recommend Fight Through It because he had great information. It'll be easier if you were listening and you couldn't quite make it out. It'll be easier the second half because I think he was off speakerphone, so it was clear. But try your best because the information is worthwhile. I was able to make out what he was saying. It was only a few spots where there was some actual static that I had trouble making out what he said, but for the rest of it, I could understand what he was saying. So hope you're able to get through it and get the information because, man, outstanding. Hopefully we can have him back on the program. Justice, did you have anything you wanted to share about today's broadcast or anything else racism related?
No. But I got to go to a soccer practice, so I'm going to show my email address. justice.asap@yahoo.com. Again, justice.asap@yahoo.com.
Groovy, groovy. Shoot her an email. Let her know. Hopefully she'll be back for Friday's program. Should be fun. I hope you have lots of fun at soccer practice and don't take any stuff from the white folks.
Yep.
For any of the folks, I guess, that called in, I will visit the phone lines. I actually want to check with Shadow first because he didn't ask any questions, so I wanted to see if he had any comments he wanted to make or anything before I hit the rest of the folks. Shadow, you should be able to chat if you want to. Did you have anything you wanted to share or any comments?
No, not yet. I had come in a little bit late, so I just want to hear what everybody's talking about, and then I might comment on something in a minute.
Ah, true. There you go. I guess my thing I'll share, number one, since we talked about the Mean Girls of Morehouse, Saturday's program, Terrence Dean, author of Hiding in Hip Hop, this Saturday evening. I can't see the actual showtime. I'll get it for you, but I would I suspect that will be a very interesting broadcast. Yes, it's this Saturday, November 13th. Showtime is 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, and 5 p.m. Pacific. Terrence Dean, author of Hiding in Hip-Hop, Homosexual Activity in the So-Called Hip-Hop Entertainment Industry. Should be very, very interesting. And we have the program before that, Friday evening, the Irritated Genie of Southeast. He and I will be having a discussion. We're picking discussions where we don't agree. We'll be discussing Black nationalism, answer to our problem, or waste of time. I am of the opinion that it could be, most likely is, a waste of time. We'll be chatting about that this Friday. Should be interesting. I think we'll be taking callers. Tune in this Friday. Should be a very entertaining discussion, and I think all of the programs that he and I do together, this Friday program, Radio Free Dixie, this is our first time doing it where he and I just have a dialogue. It's not an interview. I think all of these programs, and they're going to be the second Friday of each month, all of these programs, we're going to be picking a topic that he and I do not agree on. So these should be hopefully constructive and interesting to listen. And, you'll be hearing very different perspectives because I think we're always going to be picking topics where we have a different perspective. So tune in this Friday, So-Called Black Nationalism, Waste of Time or Answer to Our Problems. If you called in, your line should be open. Everybody that's on my Skype, I got you as well. And you can listen at War on the Horizon. So it can't be a whole lot of background noise. There's a lot of people, so you got to kind of manage the noise.
Then I like to take the pencil and outline my design.
Somebody's watching television or something. Got to get that corrected.
Little rose. I'm just
going to
do a little swirly shape here.
Okay, I figured it out. Person, last four digits, 3413. I'm assuming you're just listening. If you actually want to say anything, press 1, and you got to turn your TV down or be in a quiet spot because I'm picking up a lot of background noise. I will also check the free HD line to make sure people have not called in over there. Oh, okay. If you called in at free HD, we got you too. So everybody that called in, your line is open. If you have anything you would like to share, any comments, feel free.
I wanted to share with everybody, there was another brother murdered by the police out in Los Angeles in the Wilmington area. 21 years old, security officer for a company that did security for Home Depot. They shot him in the back 12 times. They claimed that he had a weapon and was pointing it at them, which it doesn't sound likely to me either. But so they shot and killed another brother. And a friend of mine told me that this also happened recently to someone named Prince Jones. That's not recently, but there's a case of a Prince Jones who was murdered in Virginia. And he also told me there's another brother recently in East Lansing, Michigan, that they killed as well. And my thoughts are that all the protesting and weeping and crying on TV and letting white people capture it, I feel like it needs to stop, and we need to start doing what needs to be done to let them know that when this happens, there will be consequences for them as well.
I agree with you 100% 808, because there was an incident also in the New York area with a student from Pace University that was murdered about 2 weeks ago. And the police alleged that he attempted to run them over, and they shot him and killed him in the car. But good white students were there, And I say that in a sarcastic way, and they were the ones to back up to say, no, he was not, that the police told him to move the car. He attempted to move it, and they shot into the vehicle and killed him. So hopefully the parents will be able to prevail in a civil lawsuit and get some monetary gains, because we know in a criminal case, these criminal law enforcement agents, they always end up getting off not guilty.
Yeah, my only issue is our lives are worth more than money, and if they know all they have to do is throw some money at you, they're still alive to kill more of our children. That needs to stop.
And I agree with you 100%, but it seems that some or the other, that having a badge and a weapon on their hip, that these people, they have full reign, just as they did before when we were enslaved, to do whatever they want to do. And some of them are brown and black faces that are doing the same thing. They got into this club, and they become a part of the culture, and they do the same thing to their people that they see their white counterparts, in some case worse.
Is the law the same as it was during the time that the Black Panthers would monitor the police armed openly out on the street to make sure that nothing happened to our people?
In some cases, that they have put laws on the books, because I know it's in North Carolina as well as in Maryland and a few other states, it's working its way up the East Coast, that you, before you can go around and monitor them, like take videos, it's against the law. It's called obstruction of justice if you're caught out there filming them while they're doing their job. So they have put these on the books in order that you cannot, as a citizen concerned, citizen patrol, you cannot do that anymore. And it's creeping into these communities. We're becoming into a police state. That's what this is fast becoming. We see the lights, cameras, and all of these on buildings. Now the law enforcement have it that you as a citizen, you cannot film them while they're doing whatever arrest to make sure that they're doing it by the law.
Yeah, my thing is we need to get beyond the point of worrying about filming and prevent it from happening. If they know they'll get shot, they won't be so trigger-happy to shoot us. If they know, as someone said before, if I'm shooting these, just imagine, let's just say we weren't as intensely victimized as we were, and maybe we have the mindset of some of the Muslim people, and they knew that if they shot one of us, some of theirs were going to die the next day. I think it would stop. If they knew, if I go here and we kill these people, and then suddenly something happens to one of my children or something happens to my home, I think it would cease to happen. If it didn't cease altogether, it would ease up.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that one. And it's very
I'm getting really tired of it. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I said it's very rarely that you hear sisters like yourself talking like that, but we definitely need more sisters like you that's strong enough to say that when these cops go out here and speak.
Did you know even the leading dishwashing detergent leaves residue behind?
I'm sorry. Cop up.
When these cops go out and spit and spread blood and spill blood in our neighborhood, that the same thing needs to be returned to them. And then you best believe they would think twice before they start killing and assaulting our black brothers and sisters out here. It's a shame. And more people need to stand up, like you said, and regardless of the consequences, take it back to them like they do us.
Right. Do you all remember how much fear there was and trepidation over the crazy white pastor down south that was going to burn the Quran, and everybody was begging him not to do it because of the consequences? There need to be consequences like that when our children and our young people are shot down and murdered like animals in the street. Nonviolence has not worked for 500 years with these people. They don't practice it. No amount of money can bring your children back. The civil lawsuits don't make your neighborhood safe. You know, and it was sad because a friend of mine told me that in that one case in Virginia, when he heard about it happening and some people, you know, lost their child to the policy enforcement folks, that there were some black people in his job who actually said, man, his family's going to get paid now. Like, that's the mentality. The money's worth more than the life. And we have to get out of that mindset and start valuing ourselves and our life enough to protect ourselves. And maybe that's the problem, that we don't. Maybe that's the problem right there.
Oh, I want to give an announcement. If any of you are coming to the East Coast, We are having a Black African Holocaust Conference in Atlanta. It's going to be held November 19th to the 21st, and Professor Griff is going to be there. The Kwesis are going to be there, and quite a bunch of the African luminaries, they will be there for this presentation. Dick Gregory, Paul Mooney, you name them, they will all be here in Atlanta. So if y'all are coming out this way and you would be interested in sitting in on this lecture, it's a three-day series, you can call. Is it okay, Gus, for me to give the numbers for them to call for tickets?
Oh, yeah, please do.
Yes, you can call for tickets at 1-877-579-5225. And it's going to be held November 19th to the 21st. So this should be very informative since it's going to be on the Black African Holocaust. Maybe they're going to be speaking about reparations and what we can do to push this agenda.
Are you going?
I will try to because I have to travel for my job. Right now I'm in New Orleans. I've been here for the past almost 2 weeks, and I have to leave to go to Austin in a couple of days. So hopefully I will be able to be back in Atlanta for this because I would really and truly like to be there for it.
I was just going to ask you, if you go, can you try to get Paul Mooney's info for Gus so we can have him on the show?
Right, because if I don't go, I know a couple of people who will be going there, and I will definitely try and get some information because I know, as well as Dick Gregory, because I don't know if you would be interested in having Dick Gregory on. I could also get their information as well for you that you can have him on the show because he has a few interesting things that he always puts out there.
Certainly. Any of those folks the folks that have not been on the show that are going to be there, sure, if you can get their contact information, that would be greatly appreciated. Thank you very much. Anybody who can snare that information, yes, Gus would be thankful. I'm saying this from now on. Ashra Kwesi, when he was on the program, said it's going to take 2,000 years to replace white supremacy with justice. That's just a statement of fact. He did say that. It's in the archives. He was here in August 2010.
Did he give an explanation of why he thinks it would take that long?
Yes, he did.
I'm going to have to go back and review it to hear what he has to say because it is getting to the point whereby we are seeing a lot of these because they had this article that came out once again. It seems that the Black community is under some sort of microscope and focus because we're always told that we have the most criminals, we have the most carriers of venereal diseases, we have the most out-of-wedlock children, we have the most abortions. And I'm saying this doesn't make any sense. We make up 13% of the population, but yet still everything negative is projected onto the Black family. And I'm telling people, listen, y'all have got to look and see where the source of this information is coming from. These people are trying to push this interracial marriages and the homosexuality by blowing up these numbers and telling you that these things are happening to you. They're trying to get Black men and women to seek love in the arms of other people of other ethnicity. And I'm very, very suspect of these things. And when I hear so-called learned people coming on, and they're touting these stats, and they're telling you that, yes, it's true. I have not been polled. I have not been polled for anything ever.
Right.
So I have a hard time believing these things when people are coming out with these stats, and they're trying to tell you that they try to pin the AIDS virus on us, and, okay, we were having sex with monkeys, and we brought it from Africa over here. You know, this is getting ridiculous.
It is definitely a propaganda campaign.
It is, which is why I tried to tell them. I said, you have got to look at your sources. And then all of a sudden, then I got into it today with someone on this stupid Tyler Perry movie, and they were saying, oh, it was so great, it was this. I said, what is so great about it? I said, what did Tyler Perry do? And I mentioned exactly, Gus, what you said about the 4 attempted suicide and how she was so proud of having Susan B. Anthony as a hero. I made sure I threw those 2 points in.
How did she respond to the attempted suicides?
Well, they said, we did not know. I said, you have got to look at this woman. This woman, first of all, I made sure the correlation with the flag and the symbolism with the gay community, and I was telling about Tyler Perry and everything, his negativity on the black men, that every black man that he put in his plays or movies, they're a caricature. They have no substance to them. They're just there as a fixture. The women are always strong. They're always running the household, and the men are just there as props. Because, as they said, when the movie opened, it opened with the baby being thrown out, and the baby's being thrown out of a, no, the rape scene was the first opening of the movie. And people were saying, well, we have these things in our community. I said, the white people have it in their community, too. Do you see them having it in their movies?
Mm-mm. And you know what? I have a bootleg of Precious that I really had resisted watching for a long time, and I finally decided to watch it yesterday. I didn't finish. But it's pretty telling. The very first scene of the movie, she's fantasizing about her older male white teacher and how he wants her to be his wife, or he going to be my husband, or something like that. And then I noticed pretty soon, not too far after that, was a rape scene. So, like, all these monstrosity movies have to start with rape. But I noticed when I was watching some of the reviews of people online, black people reviewing the movie, everybody kept commenting on how wonderful the acting was and how it put you through so many emotions that your head hurt at the end of the movie. You needed a aspirin or something. But I didn't hear anyone analyze the substance of the movie.
They never do. It's all about entertainment, which is why I was trying to get them to see. I said, we have got to get me on the entertainment aspect of movies and music to see that there is something deep and reoccurring in his movies, in his plays. Why is he always trying to demonize the black male? This is a black male himself. Why does he have such a negative put down about the black male that they are, you might as well say that they're useless?
I think it's honestly because he sees black men as monsters from his abusive upbringing. And that is the only thing I can think of, because his father was abusive. He was raped or sexually abused by males as well, who I'm assuming would be black. And someone said something about, you know, maybe his movies are his therapy. And I said, well, if it's his therapy, it's not working very well, because we keep seeing the same type of movie coming out, and there doesn't seem to be any growth or progress. Black men are always monsters in his movies. And like Sister Nefertari said, I really think he should go have a session with Dr. Welding, or two or three or five or ten. I really do, instead of putting this garbage out on screen.
Both him and Oprah, did you have a chance to watch the Oprah show with Katherine Jackson on yesterday?
No, I missed it.
Okay, I happened to record it on TiVo, and I went back and I watched it last night. And she was, when Joe Jackson came in, the first thing she asked, oh, by the way, are y'all still married or y'all divorced? And I'm looking at her, and I said, if I was Mr. Jackson, I would have said, you know what, this is none of your damn business. He said,
they did
both of them said, yes, we are still married. Then she's going to ask him about if he beat the children. And he said, yes, that he did spank the children, and it was part of their upbringing. And she said, because then he made a comment and said, well, none of my children have ever been incarcerated. They don't have a criminal record, and they're still here. They're still alive. He said, not too many people can say that for their children.
Mm-hmm.
And She was really and truly trying to make this man as a demon, as if though he was the way that Michael turned out, that Michael was so fragile because his father was a terrorized this boy when he was growing up. This woman has some issues. She has really some real serious issues, and I'm so glad this is her last year, because I have lost all respect for Oprah, Gayle King, Tyler Perry. I wish they would go somewhere on an island somewhere, and where they don't have access to any sort of media.
Well, Tyler Perry has an island.
Well, then he needs to take them with them where they have no access to any sort of media. Then, of course, they had the children there, the grandchildren, which is kind of dysfunctional to begin with, because Randy Jackson's wife is now Jermaine's wife, and these two brothers have children with the same woman. So now these children are your stepchildren, are also your nephews and nieces. This something that this, like you said, this is becoming ridiculous. You find things like this happening in white families that marry their cousins. But black people, we never did things like that. First of all, if Randy Jackson was married to this woman first and they got a divorce, I don't see why Jermaine got involved with her and married her and had children by her. The family dynamics is going to be totally off.
Yeah, I just saw the teaser for the program, and it showed Oprah there with Mrs. Jackson and Joe walking in and her asking, "Oh, you still live here?" Yeah, I did think that was a bit
offensive.
Unsat, as my friend would say.
They would have cut that part out, because I would have cut the camera. I would have said, "You know what, you need to cut the camera, because what I have to say, you would not want to broadcast it." And I would have just let her have it.
Well, she lucky I wasn't there. I'd have said, let's talk about Stedman.
You're right, Stedman and Gail.
Did anyone catch the program on male victims of sexual abuse? Did any of you happen to see that one?
No, I T-boated it. I haven't got to it yet.
Yeah, Tyler Perry was on that show as well.
Have any of you seen the XXL cover with 50 Cent and Soulja Boy on it?
Yes, sir.
What did you think of that, Gus?
Terrence Dean, the Saturday hiding in hip hop.
Okay.
Saturday hiding in hip hop. Yes, sir.
Okay. Because I had showed it to several people and I got mixed reactions. Some people thought it was homoerotic, some people didn't, but. Yeah, I guess we'll talk more about it later.
Not posing with my chest oiled and no shirt on with another male, but, you know, I could.
Yeah.
I'm a victim. I've been, you know, maybe I looked at it incorrectly, maybe.
Maybe. Holding his crotch. Yeah, it was kind of strange.
Very, very. But Terrence Dean, hiding in hip hop, this Saturday, November 13th.
Do you all remember some years ago Vibe put out an issue of their magazine, and it was about homo thugs and how there are a lot of homosexual men masquerading in this hip-hop veneer with the Timberlands and the jeans and the thug look?
Yeah, I read the article.
Oh, wait, let me tell you this. Sound all sensational. I was watching The Real Housewives of Atlanta. And Candy, who was formerly a member of Escape, she, you know, is a songwriter. So if any of you have watched the show, there's a young male on the show, a black male, who is the white female Kim's hairdresser or wig maker or something. He was working with her on her line of wigs. He wears foundation and makeup, high heel shoes. This is in Atlanta. He had a flash dance sweatshirt falling off of his shoulder and a woman's purse showing up at her house. Candy has decided that she is going to produce the first openly gay singer. Now, he can really sing, too, but he owns a hair salon. So they were in the studio recording this song about something about "So You Want to Keep Me in the Closet." But that is the black degeneracy that is being produced at this time.
Well, Atlanta has fast become the capital of the gay degeneracy. They have it on the West Coast. Now they have it on the Southeastern, with Atlanta being in the lead. Because I cannot understand why any of these women are calling themselves housewives. There's only two person on the show now that's married, Fedra and Nene. All of the others are not married. So I cannot understand how they classify themselves as being housewives and they're on this program.
If I can request assistance from folks that are listening, I've been trying to find the Oprah Winfrey program where Robert F. Williams was a guest. If any folks, you know, can do some research and dig and see if they can find that. If you can just find the date, if you can find information about it, I would be interested in that. Professor Watkins, he said that it was roughly 10 years ago. So, I don't know, 99-ish, 2000-ish, maybe. if you can work on that, that would be great. I'm sure a lot of listeners would, you know, really enjoy seeing that. And I put my name at the top of the list. So if you can work on that, Gus would appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, Gus, I did want to ask you something yesterday. It might have been me. I kept pressing the one button, but I guess you could never hear me. I was trying to get more information on the blood guy that the genie was looking for, because I know somebody who would probably know every blood that has a big name or would be well-known and could probably find him. Can you give me a little more information on the guy or what the project is called that he did?
The name of the film that he made is titled Bastards of the Party.
Okay.
His name is, give me 1 second and I can give you his name. Okay. His name is Clay Sloan. Clay, C-L-E, Sloan, S. L-O-A-N, Clay Sloan. I guess his nickname is Bone, and the documentary is Bastards of the Party.
Okay, can I find the documentary online?
Oh, yeah. You can watch the whole thing online. It's on Google Video.
Okay, cool. I'll send it to my contact and see if we can come up with something.
Yeah, he was on NPR, too. Like, he's pretty well known. The documentary came out a couple years ago, so...
Okay, thank you. Oh, on the nonviolent solution thing, it was so funny because I was driving in the car yesterday afternoon, and there was a news show that comes on, I guess, in the evening drive times, whatever. They were talking about President Obama being over in India and the hypocrisy, but they were just falling over giggling in the studio how he had met with whatever leaders in India, and he just made some multi-billion dollar arms deal where the United States is the number one manufacturer and an exporter of weapons, and India, who's the number one importer. So they're selling, I don't know if it was $9 billion, some huge number worth of fighter planes to India. And at the same time he's over there, he's quoting Gandhi and Martin Luther King on nonviolence being the solution and the only rationable and reasonable way to handle things while he's selling billions of dollars worth of weapons to India.
That would not surprise me in the least bit. Remember, the Indians are trying to get a seat on the UN.
Right. But the blame...
part of the strategy, he went over there. He is selling them more debt because he took with him on his trip over there, he took a guy from Boeing, Walmart, Harley Davidson, and quite a few people over there with him in order for jobs. So there goes more jobs being exported into India, with Walmart trying to open up more of their stores in India, because the Indian people is going to put them a lot out of business, because most Indian, they have these mom-and-pop stores that we used to have before the Walmart came in and took over. No, you can't even find a mom-and-pop store.
That was just commenting. Just the hypocrisy of even promoting that nonviolent fantasy while you're obviously supporting violent means by selling weapons. I mean, that's how you know it doesn't work, and he got the Nobel Peace Prize. They were laughing about that, too. They said they guess that was in his candidacy years, you know, the candidacy period, before he got into weapon sales.
This president is promoting the corporate agenda. That's what he is there for. He is there to sell their business. It's the same thing that they were speaking of with Iraq, and they're talking about it, but they pulled out. Yes, the military might have left, but they still have all of the contractors and the mercenaries. They're still on the ground in Iraq. It would not make sense for you to build the largest embassy and for you to desert it.
Right.
This is what they did. They have the largest U.S. embassy is in Iraq and in Pakistan, the one that they're building in Pakistan and over in Afghanistan. So why would you build these things and then just abandon it and leave?
I read a quote one time that said that all true power comes from the end of a knife or a barrel of a gun. I don't know if that's
exactly
true.
What this president is doing. We are spending more money. Mm-hmm. They keep speaking of the budget. We can't cut taxes. They don't want to let the tax break for the the upper echelon to expire. They don't have money, but you're still. They don't want to cut the military budget. They're saying the military budget has to keep going up. We're spending over half, about 55 cents to the dollar, is spent on the military. So where else are you going to get money from? We don't have a steel industry. We don't have manufacturing. We have absolutely nothing. Only thing we have is the weapons that we sell to these different countries that are going to turn around and use it back on us within another 5 to 6 years.
I'm going to go about another 5 or so, and then I'm going to relax a little bit since I have a lot of shows coming up the rest of the week. We'll be back Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Yeah, context of white supremacy. Anyway, I did want to get this in, and then you all can take – I won't start the 5 minutes until I'm done. Apparently, not all non-white people have been totally duped by this Tyler Perry foolishness for colored girls. I wanted to share this earlier, like yesterday's program, but I forgot. Actually, Sunday's program, but I forgot. Number one, this is on boxofficemojo.com. For Colored Girls, made $19.5 million on close to 2,900 screens at 2,127 locations. These statistics could be false, but white people tend to be, you know, very informed about things. As sizable as it was, that was on the lower end for a Tyler Perry movie, Amen. Although it did not bear his name in the title like his previous movies, and it lacked his usual comedic elements, being his first adaptation of someone else's work. Among other comparable titles, it was bigger than Beloved and The Secret Life of Bees, though it was smaller than Waiting to Exhale, thank goodness, and Poetic Justice. Distributor Lionsgate exit polling showed that 82% of the audience was female, 87% was over 25 years old, and 81% was black. Now, again, these statistics could be incorrect, but I thought those demographics were pretty staggering, that mostly over 25 black females were the folks who went to see this film. Very interesting. But again, smaller numbers than his normal film. And then at NPR, I just found this while I was trying to get something else. For Colored Girls or Not, this came out today. This had just a couple minutes ago, actually. We are having a raging debate in this office about the new movie For Colored Girls, and we are not the only ones. Take the most recent column by Richard Prince, who edits the online publication Journalisms. In it, Prince describes how some of the reviews are so over-the-top negative that they have sparked reviews of the reviews. I did not know this has been getting very poor reviews. That's great. Here's one by Cortland Malloy. Oh, I read that one. I posted that on Facebook. Lots of people have posted that on Facebook, the one by Cortland Malloy from The Washington Post. The headline says it all for black men who have considered homicide after watching another Tyler Perry movie. And then there's Wesley Morris of the Boston Globe to quote, "It's too much screaming, too much crying, too much preaching, too much reaching, too much healing, too much feeling. And by the time a man dangles two small black children from an apartment window, it's too much, too much." To which Rhonda Rasha Penrice, writing for news website thegrio.com, says mainstream reviews of the film have been laced with a viciousness rarely seen when evaluating the work of other filmmakers. I'm glad to hear that. Oh, my God. You have already heard from our digital media guy, Lee Hill. He wants to know why there's been no For Colored Boys yet. Many of you told him, go write it yourself. And now we want to hear from you, blah, 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 blah. And I'm elated to hear that this film is getting poor reviews. Hoorah, hoorah.
After you read the statistics of who was in the audience, I thought it would have been perfect to play a clip of Beyonce's All the Single Ladies. I just see a bunch of unhappy, man-hating females in the theater. And from what I've seen online, the conversations about it, tend to spark that who's to blame for the state of black relationships, black men or black women, and kind of the oppression Olympics discussion.
Well, I am glad that people are finally waking up to see, start seeing him for what he is, because all of his movies that have the same dynamic. It's always ending in some religious overtone about God heal all things, Jesus will heal it, and the dysfunctional male, dysfunctional women, and the children. So it's been played out, and pretty soon he's going to have to fold up his tent and go somewhere else and start producing homosexual movies for the white mainstream. Because that is pretty much what it's leading up to.
I sure hope not. I sure hope he didn't produce that stuff.
Well, most people went to the movies because people like Felicia LaRashad, I don't see how she got herself caught up into this mess. Because she is normally pretty, does some pretty conscious stuff. Whoopi Goldberg, it's to be expected. Her career is fading. Loretta Devine, I really and truly didn't expect that. These are the old hits. I cannot see how they let themselves.
Conscious stuff? I don't know about, did you say Felicia Rashad normally does pretty conscious stuff?
Yeah, she somewhat does some conscious things, she, at least from what the few that I can remember. The last thing that she did was it A Raisin in the Sun that I remember she did on Broadway?
Lord. I don't know if that's much better than For Colored Girls. I'm waiting. That's going to be on an upcoming show. I would say Raisin in the Sun. You want to talk about poor example of black masculinity. My Lord, Walter Lee is right.
Yeah.
And Lorraine Hansberry. Oh, my Lord. Lorraine Hansberry. Yeah.
Of course.
And I think Felicia Rashad is most known for The Cosby Show. I don't I don't know. I guess it depends on how you feel about The Cosby Show.
But she used to do soap operas back in the 80s. What was it, One Life to Live, she was on that show.
Is that conscious?
Yeah, that was way back in the early 80s, the late 70s, early 80s. She was on One Life to Live, I believe it was on ABC. Was it her? I think she was on one of those shows, one of those soaps she was on, if I'm not mistaken.
Gus, do you see The Cosby Show as a negative?
Oh, man. I could do a whole show about The Cosby Show. I feel like The Cosby Show is, if we're talking about a system that is based on deception, I do not think in any way that that show presents an authentic, accurate picture of life for black people in a system of white supremacy. I think that program was on for well over 6 years, and I don't recall anyone ever coming to that house and making a gripe or complaint about having been mistreated by a white person, ever. In my opinion, the program encourages interracial relationships. It encourages being friendly with white people. In my opinion, the program does nothing to support non-white people becoming more informed about racism, white supremacy. Absolutely nothing. It does not present white people as being racist. It does not present white people as being folks that you should be suspicious of. In fact, I think there's so much hanging out and fraternizing with white people. It's, hey, white people are grand. There's nothing wrong with white people. We're all hanging out and getting along great. And in fact, I would say it's at its worst. The time that I remember them really addressing racism, Theo, who's played by Malcolm Jamal Warner, he had a school project on the March on Washington. Now, I hope folks heard the broadcast with Irritated Genie where we talked about Negroes with guns and the Deacons for Defense program with Dr. Lance Hill. And this is one. People wrote me some emails talking about they didn't like bashing Martin Luther King. This is one I can roll my sleeves up and box anybody on this one. I studied under Julian Bond at the University of Virginia. I know what I'm talking about on this one. That March on Washington is racist, white supremacist at their best. That would be the last thing I would point to and say this is the crystal example of black people at their best fighting against racism. They present it was the whole GUI romanticized. Oh, he was great. And I think Bill Cosby, Cliff, his dad was there. And he's like, oh, we were there. It was wonderful. We sung songs. We marched. It was incredible. I mean, and then they end the show. They have the audio playing, and they're sitting around the television like they're watching video footage of the march, and everybody is sitting around, and it's just silent, and they're looking so serious, and it's just like, oh, and I think it played the first time that episode aired. It played on, like, Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday or the anniversary, the holiday that they gave him, something like that. But I felt like that's racism, white supremacy at their worst, where they take a moment that really is about white people being able to subvert black people. It was not King. It was not Roy Wilkins. It was not the NAACP. It was not the SCLC that said, let's go march on Washington. It was regular old nameless black people who were upset, who had been brutalized by white people. They were tired. They were going to D.C. to shut things down, lay down on the runway, do whatever they could to disrupt things, to make white people stop practicing racism. White people totally took that over, picked out black people that they could control, put them in charge, including, and most importantly, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., gave them money up front and gave them the promise of more money if they could do this and have no violence, have no mischief in D.C. It is no coincidence. Martin Luther King Jr. got the Time Magazine Man of the Year right after 63. It is no coincidence. That is the same year he won the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, that in the newspaper, I said that on the program, you don't even have to go to a black source at all. You can read the Washington Post for July 4th, 1963, that is a good month and a half before the march, they say exactly what I'm saying. White people were scared. They were nervous about that march. They brought in the Big Six, the black people that they had control over, including Martin Luther King Jr. They brought them to New York. Exactly what I'm saying. You can read this in the Washington Post. If you want more information, you can read Malcolm X's autobiography. He has a whole chapter on this. You can read James Forman's book, The Making of Black Revolutionaries. He has a whole chapter on this where he breaks, and he was there. It's tons of stuff. I mean, The Cosby Show, in my opinion, is terrible. I guess some people say it shows, you know, quality examples of black relationships, and well, it's certainly not a black male in a dress. For sure, you get to see a black female who's working, intelligent. She's an attorney. You get to see Cliff. He's a doctor. I guess, but in my opinion, it's just a totally fanciful version of black family life in a system of white supremacy, and at their worst when they're romanticizing the 1963 March on Washington. So I would give The Cosby Show 8 thumbs down, in my opinion. I mean, you can just look at, you know, Bill Cosby. You can just, you know, if that, however you feel about Bill Cosby, I guess it's also going to have a lot to do with how you feel about The Cosby Show, but that is my opinion, and I could be incorrect.
Hey, Gus, did you post that article on your webpage? Because I was trying to find it, at Washington Post article that you mentioned in 63, because I did remember, I have it on my phone here, my iPhone, that where Dr. Malcolm X gave a speech. It was in Harlem right before that, and he gave the layout of where all the money sources was, who funded what, and who paid for
that's
everything.
That's just to the grassroots. That's the name of the speech he gave. Message to
I
the
have it saved on my iPhone, and I would suggest that anyone could go out there and to save it, because it's about an hour long, and he told everything about all of them, who was paid off, what hotel they were in, and when the money exchanged hands.
Message to the grassroots. You can read it, and you can listen to it online. The speech Malcolm X gave, Message to the Grassroots. And that article, I heard you, there's an article in Present Africaine. It's an African literary journal. You can get the 1963 fall edition. It's a quarterly, so get the third one.
What's it called? Let me write this down.
Present Africaine. It's an African literary journal. You'll probably have to go to a major university. Oh, you're in Atlanta. Yeah, you're good. Just go to either Georgia Tech or Emory. They'll probably have it. But Present Africaine. The name of the article is the August 28, 1963 March on Washington, and it's subtitled The Castrated Giant. It's all about the March on Washington. It's by Michael Thelwell. He was in SNCC. black male. He said almost verbatim everything the irritated genie said when he was on the program talking about Robert F. Williams and the foolishness of that march and Martin Luther King Jr. is in that article. Presence After King, 1963. The author is Michael Thelwell. You can Google the two. It'll pop up. The August 28, 1963, March on Washington, a castrated giant. There were a lot of black people who were not fooled by what went down in D.C. Malcolm X is probably just the most well-known, but there were tons of black people who saw that for the foolishness it was even back then. Whoever had a question, go ahead.
I was going to ask you, do you feel like the Cosby Show then would be a polar opposite, an exaggeration on the opposite spectrum of good times?
I mean, it's one and the same, almost. It's just one, they have resources, and one, they don't. But it's pretty much the same show. The only thing I can say is, at least in good times, you do hear gripes occasionally about racism and white supremacy. I think good times, I see more of an honest effort to at least say, hey, white people are causing us a lot of problems in good times. That totally disappears in the Cosby Show. So I would say, I mean, it's a thin line even separating the two. In my opinion, they're both just black comedies at the end of the day. That's really all they're known for. It's just black people being silly and making jokes. I guess in one you can say, well, it's black people. They're struggling, having a tough time. They make some honest comments about racism. The other one, black people are doing well. It's showing them being smart, educated, having great jobs. But racism, what racism? What are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
You are very accurate in that. That's why when Dr. Watkins was on tonight and he was talking about the school system, and people are all so gung-ho and all up in arms about these so-called black institutions and what good that they are doing, these people are doing the same mess that they have done. Remember, what's the name that Carter G. Woodson said that he it took him over 20 years to re-educate himself after finishing up at Harvard, because they have a good way of brainwashing you and getting you to indoctrinate you into thinking and performing a certain way, and that's the same thing these schools have done. And the Rockefellers, they have been known for that. It's the same thing I was mentioning with, I do a lot of research, and I was mentioning with Leo Hansberry, who's the uncle of Lorraine Hansberry, and how this man was denied tenure. He was denied funding and all of these different things that he was denied all by the Rockefeller Foundation, because this man was going to prove along the same lines as Stolen Legacy with George D.M. James, about the things that you've been taught in school about Greek this and Roman that it had nothing to do with them. It all came out of the African continent. And they wanted to slow him down. They wanted to stop him. And I was fortunate in order to meet with Dr. John Henry Clark, and he said the same thing about the March on Washington. He said the same thing about the Million Man March, how it was all a waste of time.
It was a lot of white people at that march. I guess we have about 2 minutes left in the program. It was a lot of white people at that march. That should let you know a lot about what went down there and if it was constructive or not. And I guess my last comment would be, I think Malcolm X, he has a fantastic quote where he says, if someone who's supposed to be on my team, we're in a war, someone who's supposed to be on my side, and the opposition tends to give them awards, prizes, treats. I tend to get suspicious of them, especially if they give them a peace prize and the war is still on. We'll be back on Thursday, and we'll be back on War on the Horizon tomorrow, King Samir's broadcast. Philip A. Muhammad, Willie Lynch's newest slave, he'll be on. He'll be King Samir's guest tomorrow, 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific. The Cows will be back on Thursday, 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. How to Deal with White People should be great. We'll be back. We're about gone. We'll be out. Cows signing out. Thank you all for tuning in. We'll be back soon. Thank you. Replace white supremacy.